Lansing, Michigan, ground zero today for organized labor. From APM, this is the Marketplace Midday Update podcast. I'm Jeff Horwich. It is the 11th of December. Happy Tuesday. The right-to-work battle is raging in Michigan. We'll take you there. A huge penalty for a money-laundering bank. The IMF delays a big bunch of money that was headed for Egypt. And what's the difference between $10 and $15 an hour? Well, it's bigger than you might think.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
The Michigan State Capitol today is hosting thousands of protesters. The House is taking up a so-called right-to-work bill. It seems likely the Republican-controlled chamber will pass the measure, and it'll go on to GOP Governor Rick Snyder. From our Wealth and Poverty Desk, Marketplace's Chrissy Clark is in Michigan to cover the debate. Hello, Chrissy.
Hello.
Right to work. This is such a fraught term. I don't know if it's possible to define it in a totally neutral way, but I'm going to ask you to give us your best shot. What is it?
Right. Well, even using the term right to work is kind of a politically charged phrase, because who doesn't want the right to work, right? But basically, a right to work law bans unions from requiring employees to pay dues or fees as a condition of employment. So, you know, union dues are, of course, a percentage of a worker's paycheck, usually equal to about 2 or 3 hours of work a month. And the money goes to things like covering the costs of contract negotiations, union admin stuff, and some general political causes. Supporters of right to work laws say it's not fair to require employees to pay those dues or fees, and that it makes the state less attractive to businesses. Opponents of right to work say this kind of law weakens unions, which they argue help improve wages and working conditions, not just for union members, but for everyone.
So you won't necessarily have to join the union in order to become employed at a unionized workplace.
Exactly. But you would still theoretically be getting the benefits that having a union contract there would give to that workplace.
So this right-to-work thing has played out in a number of other states. Why has Michigan, at this moment, become such a battleground?
Well, remember, Michigan is where the United Auto Workers Union started back in the 1930s. It was sort of the birth of the industrialized labor movement. And many here feel that the union created the middle class as we know it for many workers. So for a lot of people here, this feels like an attack on that middle class dream. But on the other hand, you have people who say in this tough economic climate we're in, states need to make themselves as competitive as they can to businesses. And if that means weakening unions and making workplaces more flexible, they argue, that's what should be done.
So what's next after the vote today?
Well, as soon as today, the state legislature could pass the bill, which would then go to the governor's desk. He says he'll sign it. Michigan would be the 24th state to pass a right-to-work law. If it does go through, opponents, meanwhile, are already talking about lawsuits, recall efforts, both for the governor and for the state legislators who are expected to pass this bill. So it's not going to end today.
Marketplace's Chrissy Clark in Michigan. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yesterday, if you called up the podcast, I told you about Standard Chartered, which is settling with the U.S. government after admitting it handled millions in illegal transactions related to Iran, Myanmar, and Libya. Today, it is the British bank HSBC, which is set to pay almost $2 billion to settle its U.S. case of money laundering. The penalty is the biggest in U.S. banking history. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
The offences were fairly blatant, not sophisticated chicanery like interest rate rigging. HSBC admitted money laundering on a heroic scale. It funneled billions of dollars from Mexican drug cartels into the US, dealt with terrorists, did business with rogue states like Iran. The penalties the bank's paying is undeniably large, but it amounts to only 10% of HSBC's annual profit. Money laundering expert Jeffrey Robinson is not impressed.
For a bank, it's simply the cost of doing business. Unless you throw bankers in jail and you put them in armed jumpsuits and you lock them away for a while, it will continue.
HSBC said it was profoundly sorry. One senior executive has resigned, some bonuses have been clawed back, and the bank is spending $250 million tightening up its controls. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Over the next few days, it looks like the U.S. government's bailout of insurance giant AIG is going to come to a reasonably happy ending. The government is going to start selling the last of its AIG shares, at a profit even. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has more.
Remember this?
It was an historic day, with Wall Street shaken to its very foundation today.
That historic day was September 15, 2008. CNBC reporter Mary Thompson stood outside AIG's headquarters with the bad news.
Late-breaking news tonight, AM Best as well as Fitch cutting their ratings on AIG. Keep in mind it has assets to sell, but it needs both time and money to tide it over until those sales go through.
AIG got the time and money it needed. Taxpayers threw the company a lifeline. At one time, the government owned more than 90% of AIG. Now the Treasury Department is announcing the sale of its remaining shares in the company. The company is out with a cheerful video talking about how it's kept its promises to the U.S. government. How did AIG do it? Joel Naroff of Naroff Economic Advisors says the company sold off lots of assets, concentrating on its core insurance business.
Some of the really risky kinds of investments that got them into trouble have been unwound. They're doing what they were doing originally. They're really back to the more basic kind of business.
Investors like that. The stock has been rising. And as of today, the government has made a profit of more than $22 billion from its initial AIG investment of $182 billion. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
And let's do the numbers. Well, it's hard to point to any one thing, but the markets this morning so far, at least, are having a very strong day. The Dow is up about 0.75%, sitting at 13,266. The S&P 500 is up almost a full percent, and the NASDAQ is up 1.6%. The Federal Reserve Committee that sets U.S. monetary policy meets today and tomorrow. The Fed has been buying bonds and securities off and on since 2008, and it said it'll continue that until the conditions in the labor market improve substantially. Delta Airlines confirms it will purchase almost half of Richard Branson's Virgin Atlantic. The two would engage in joint marketing and scheduling if antitrust regulators on both sides of the Atlantic approve. And the U.S. trade deficit grew in October to $42 billion. The economic troubles elsewhere mean fewer people abroad are buying our exports. One last data point for you. The Labor Department said this morning employers are advertising more jobs this fall. If the labor market's picking up, dare we permit ourselves to think about not only working, but actually being happy in our work. The career planning website MyPlan.com is out with a survey of the jobs that make people happiest. And let's just run through it a little bit. Their top 10 list is kind of a fascinating mix. Pediatrician, firefighter, school counselor, aircraft assembler, all right, and a criminal investigator. And now from the bottom 10 on the list, telemarketer, housekeeper, and pretty much anything with clerk in the title, motel clerk, city government clerk, and at the bottom of the list, office mail clerk. The survey's happiest job, by the way, singer. Not clear, of course, if singing while working as a mail clerk makes it any easier to get through the day.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
The International Monetary Fund says a $4.8 billion loan for Egypt is on hold. The IMF cited unfolding developments on the ground. It was going to approve the loan this month. Now it looks like January at the earliest. The IMF had warned that the loan could be jeopardized if there were any policy shifts in Egypt that might make it more difficult for the government to trim its budget deficit. BBC correspondent John Line is in Cairo, and he's with me now. Hello, John.
Yes, hello.
So what's your understanding, John, of the reason for the delay?
Well, it's the Egyptian government that's asked the IMF to postpone their request for a loan, a $4.8 billion loan to Egypt. They said it wasn't the right time. I think the simple fact is quite clear that for Egypt to get that loan, the government is going to have to do some matters to tighten up the finances. For example, we did hear today that some tax raises were just postponed. We don't know if that's related to this. But I think it was really the fear from the Egyptian government that the conditions of the loan would be for Egypt to reduce subsidies and put up taxes, in other words, to balance the books, and that all those things would be very dangerous things to do at a time when you've got a lot of people out on the streets against you already.
If this loan, some $4.8 billion, I guess, is delayed for a month or put off even longer, what could be the economic consequences for Egypt?
The worst thing that could happen would be is if the IMF explicitly rejected giving a loan to Egypt. As it is, a lot of other international lenders, a lot of people with their money in Egypt are waiting to see this. And I think there will be fears that the currency, the Egyptian pound, could go down. I haven't seen if there's been any immediate reaction, but the currency in the markets will obviously see this as a sign of uncertainty. And particularly, that would be very worrying for Egypt. This country is heavily dependent on imports of food and fuel, and so any collapse in the currency could have very bad results indeed.
And could there be political consequences of this decision within Egypt?
Well, I'd put it the other way around, really. It is the result of political factors. We're in a kind of a chain of events here that Egypt needs to get a constitution as a precursor to getting a parliament, and then once there's a new parliament, they can obviously, or they will have had elections, then they can start taking some tough decisions. You know, nobody puts taxes up the week before an election, for example, anywhere in the world. So really, Egyptian politics, like the whole country, really, are in gridlock at the moment.
John Lyne is the BBC's correspondent in Cairo. Thank you so much, John.
My pleasure.
In the last few weeks, workers at Walmart and McDonald's have walked off the job, demanding a raise. The average pay for workers at those places is not much above minimum wage. But there are a few exceptions where service workers make considerably more. Wealth and Poverty reporter Chrissy Clark introduces us to some of those workers to see what a few more bucks an hour means to them.
For one, it means a few thousand bucks more a year. Might not sound like a lot, but that extra money can be a sort of tipping point for a lot of other things, according to Johnny Smith. He's a 32-year-old with a snidely whiplash mustache who worked for many years at Trader Joe's, and he's taking me to his old store to show me what he means. The parking lot is a mess. Angry drivers honking and jostling. Smith says he's seen fistfights break out.
It gets pretty brutal. And I'm like, come on, you're buying produce.
But in the middle of all that customer angst, Smith says the people working inside, behind the counter, stay pretty happy.
A lot of customers ask, like, what do they do? Everyone just seems to be in such a great mood.
The answer, Smith says, is mostly about math. The average wage for a cashier in the U.S. is around $10 an hour. But at Trader Joe's, it's more like $15.
Obviously, if you're making a lot more money an hour, you want to hold on to that.
Smith worked a minimum wage job before he started at TJ's. Once he was making a little more,
I thought I, like, hit the jackpot. I was able to afford gasoline. My diet improved dramatically.
From fast food dollar menus to fresh food now and then. Robert Polin is an economist at the University of Massachusetts. He's interviewed dozens of workers who got raises from low to so-called living wages. He asked them what changed, and they mentioned things like paying off credit card debt or taking a class to develop a new skill.
It's not like it helped people to dramatically get ahead, but enabled them to stop falling behind.
I have no children. That's the only reason why I was barely getting by with the low wages.
John Castro is a cook who, until recently, made $12 an hour. Even that was tough, he says, in an expensive city like L.A. Then he got a job cooking in a unionized hotel downtown and started making $17 an hour. One of the best things that changed about his life?
It's easier to, like, date.
It's not just that he can afford to take someone out to dinner now. It's that he feels better about himself, which makes it easier to ask a person out. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
And finally, with the election behind us now, I guess political pollsters are trying to mix things up a little bit. Today, the firm Public Policy Polling informs us that 44% of Americans, when asked in a phone survey, believe Santa Claus is a Democrat. That compares to 28% who say he's a Republican, and another 28% who presumably greeted such a bizarre question with stunned silence. So what party do you think Santa Claus is? I think he's a socialist or a communist, maybe. You know, he's always wearing red. And he does keep a very meticulous naughty list. That's all for the Marketplace Midday Update. I'm Jeff Horwich. This is APM, American Public Media.